thanks so much. It's really a great pleasure to be here. Thanks, first of all, for hosting these. I think this is a great opportunity to get people together who are interested to talk about these sorts of topics. So I'm really glad that you're doing it here. As you mentioned, I've been traveling, so I'm sorry I haven't been able to make it to more of these. And thanks to all of you for coming out. Wow. There's a lot of things to do on a Thursday night. I'm glad that you chose to spend a little bit of time here with me. I hope it'll be worth your while. What I'd like to do tonight is to talk to you a little bit about what we've learned from looking at human race car drivers and how these sorts of things can actually help us to influence how autonomous vehicles or driver assistance systems may work in the future. My plan is not to talk for the whole period of time. I sort of cut this down, so I figure I'll go talk for about half an hour or so and then leave the rest of the time open for questions. So if you have anything that relates to my talk, if there's something that you're totally confused about, go ahead and ask it here. If you want to talk sort of more broadly about things or deep philosophical questions of automated driving, maybe we can leave that for the Q&A session at the end. And I mean that literally. I'm actually working with a philosopher on the ethics of autonomous vehicles now. So literally, if you want to ask philosophical questions, I'm totally game for that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about human race car drivers. And I also want to start off with one of my big pet peeves of autonomous driving. There's a real question in my mind. Obviously, people want autonomous vehicles to be safe. And this is one of the arguments that's often used. It's certainly one that's a huge personal motivator for me. We should look at autonomous vehicles because we can dramatically improve vehicle safety. The usual argument is, well, why do we think autonomous vehicles will help? Well, human error is responsible for about 90% of accidents. Depending upon what statistics you're drawing from, that number can vary, but about that amount. And so if we eliminate the human, then we eliminate human error. And it's amazing how many newspaper articles I read that make this, or how many statements that I hear that make this claim. And I think this is absolutely false. And so if I accomplish nothing else in the course of the next year, I would love to kind of reframe this argument, because I feel that autonomous vehicles or automated vehicles do not eliminate human error at all. All they do is they shift it. They shift it from the driver to the programmer. Now, if you think about it, that's a really good shift in many cases. How many of you have been driving and think, you know, I would love to hit the rewind button? If I could go back about 10 seconds, 15 seconds, and behave differently, I would. I mean, how many of us would like to be able to sit there and think about our most stressful driving situations, and instead of trying to solve those while you're behind the wheel, to say, I'd love to solve that while I'm sitting at the computer at the desk, going, yeah, maybe I shouldn't do it. No, why don't we try this? And be able to game that out. So there's a lot of advantages, potentially, with being able to shift from driving error to programming error. But it's a big challenge. And so if you think about this, what will programmers have to handle? Well, all manner of things. So what about the case of kids running out from a vehicle with very little warning? Maybe you've got a ball rolling out, and you can use that to predict. But you have to be able to think about the sort of things we intuit. Ball must be followed by child. Perfectly logical, all of us would think it, but are we going to think about it when we're programming? What about other things? Well, obviously, in Japan, there are some difficult pedestrian identification problems, like you would get at Shibuya Station here. And as we think about things that can be used internationally, pedestrian detection and avoidance is a huge issue. I'll point out that that's not only internationally. In fact, there are some difficult things that you might find in San Francisco. And if you think about it, it's like, well, all right, I programmed the autonomous vehicle to understand cars, to understand bicycles, to understand pedestrians. I didn't actually program it to think about how to interpret a hot tub rolling down the street or a woolly mammoth. Now, we look at these things immediately, and we know what's going on. It's a parade. We've got context. We know how to handle it. But remember, we need, as programmers, to explicitly think of these things and give the car some rules to follow. Otherwise, the car is going to be stuck trying to figure out, what do I do in this situation? And if that seems far-fetched, think about the last time that you called up some automated telephone service. Press 1 if you want this, 2 if you want that, 3 if you want this. How many times do you listen through and go, I don't want any of those. Go straight to the operator. Right? Unfortunately, there's not necessarily going to be an operator that the autonomous vehicle can go straight to. So I sort of approach this problem with equal parts of complete passion and terror. On the one hand, I think this is a fantastic opportunity. Imagine what we can do. Imagine all of the accident situations that we can take and turn into programming exercises. Imagine the number of people who would be with us here today if we could have done that years ago. Many members of my family and friends, I'm sure many of you have people in the audience who you would love to have here tonight. What an outstanding thing. This is why I became an engineer. At the same time, this is one of the most humbling problems I've ever looked at. Because how do you explain to somebody, I don't know why my computer is doing this, so I will periodically use this. Don't say it. Let me just cancel out from that. Well, that lost a little bit of momentum now, didn't it? I did make my point, huh? Yeah, exactly. That may be a human error as opposed to actual. I'm going to get this back. Watch. Okay. Any presentation will do, right? So why is it not? Where is my piece on the other side? All right. So there's a huge potential to save lives, but a big responsibility. And the question that I was going to pose in a dramatic fashion before my computer caused me to do other things is, how do you explain as a programmer to somebody that they lost their car or they lost their child because there was something that you didn't think of? This is, I think, the humbling responsibility. And this is a problem that we face, the potential to do unparalleled good. I mean, what else are we going to do as engineers that has the potential to save so many lives each year, but a huge responsibility? So this is a big puzzle, and obviously there's lots of pieces to it. Here's the one that we're attacking right now. There's many situations where the car's ability to move can be limited by the amount of friction in the environment. Maybe it's raining, maybe it's snowing, or maybe you need to get out of harm's way as quickly as possible. You don't have much space to maneuver. And you need to use all of the friction between the tire and the road to get out of trouble. So this is really a question that we've been asking. One class of accidents, clearly not everything, but one class of accidents involves needing to take all of the friction between the tire and the road and maneuver the vehicle safely out of harm's way. Well, there's a group of people who do this routinely, who are extremely good at it. And these are race car drivers. Now, they use all of the available friction to go fast, but as they say in racing, if you want to finish first, you have to finish. Collision avoidance is actually a very important part of racing. Now, they are trying to push the car out to the very limits of friction for speed. We want to actually push it out to the very limits of friction to be safe, to basically execute any maneuver that would avoid an accident if the laws of physics say that maneuver is possible. So we started to ask, how do they do this, and what can we learn? Now, I've been looking at vehicle dynamics for quite some time, I guess, the Dark Ages, as Martin pointed out. And so this was a really interesting problem to me. So we started a project with Audi to see if we could race as well as the very best human drivers. And if we could race as well as the best human drivers, could this teach us how to design safer cars? Now, this was something that appealed to me because of my background in this area. So as for those of you who aren't familiar with my background, we're going to give a quick rundown so you understand where I was coming from on this project. I started out getting my PhD at UC Berkeley working with the California PATH program, where I had the opportunity to work with Steve Schladover, who I think you heard from a couple months ago. So we were doing platooning of Lincoln Town cars down in San Diego, and I did the throttle and brake control for these vehicles. I then went on to work for Daimler-Benz and Freightliner and got to work on projects like this. I did multi-body dynamics and vehicle dynamics for large, heavy trucks like this airport rescue vehicle. After coming to Stanford, we built several vehicles in our lab, including a Chevy Corvette that we modified to be steer-by-wire, P1 and X1, which are entirely student-built drive-by-wire vehicles. Some of the design teams here in the room today. P1, we believe, is the world's first autonomous drifting car, and X1 is being used for a variety of studies now. I even do this stuff when I have a chance at free time. For a while, I was a crew chief on a quarter midget for my older son and take many opportunities to get out on the go-kart track. So having a lot of vehicle dynamics experience, it was really clear to me how to proceed with this problem of developing an autonomous race car. So pretty much the problem seemed pretty straightforward to me. We're going to find the best single path around the track. Now, this is great. We have computers. We can optimize this. We can really nail the best way around the track. Once we do, we're going to have a big advantage over the human who is, like, you know, trying to figure this out from their eyes and from various sensors and things like that. Doggone it, we can nail the line around the track. Once we have that, we'll drive right up below the limits that the tires have. So the tires have some sort of limits. We get, I don't know, I wasn't sure what the number was, 85, 90% or so of the way there on the optimal line. We should just be moving around the track. We're faster and we declare victory. So this problem set out very clearly for me even before we started working on it. Now the problem was, it turns out this wasn't really all that important to find the single best path around the track. When we found a really good path, it really didn't give us any advantage. We were able to very successfully drive just below the tire limits, and we were slow. So, if you still want to listen to the talk after realizing how little I understood, I'd like to share with you why these things were true. Ah, thank you. Okay. It's going to be a night like that, isn't it? Let me make sure I hit the right button here and get us back. Boom. So why? Well, what we're going to do is take a look at racing lines. So I'm going to show you some data that we've recorded from expert race car drivers. We're going to break down a little bit about what they do. We're going to produce some of our own racing lines and compare them and then show they how they drive with Shelly, which is the autonomous Audi TTS that we've developed with Audi in the Electronics Research Lab, and then compare that with an expert driver. Doggone it. And then what I want to do is to extend these lessons to collision avoidance. Positive appearance. I may try and plug in this in a minute. Okay, so how do drivers go around a racetrack? Well, they do it in a way that's called the cornering sequence. This is really key to understanding things here, so I want to do with you what I do with my classes at Stanford and ask you to stand up here for a moment. I want you to truly understand what it's like to drive around the track, around the racing line. So what we're going to do is we're going to go through this corner. This is turn 11 in Laguna Seca. It's the tightest turn on the track. So we're going to go in here on the straight, and if you're on the straight, you either want to be accelerating or braking at all times. Right? So we're going to brake into the corner. We're going to ease off the brakes as we start to go around. We're going to corner, and then we're going to ease out of the corner as we begin to accelerate. What this will do is move us along the friction circle. When we brake, we're going to use all of the car's friction for braking. Then we're going to ease off braking and use it all ultimately for cornering, ease off of the corner, and ultimately use it all for acceleration. So anytime we're on the straight, we only want to be accelerating or braking. All right, so you're in your car, and you accelerate. What do you feel? Okay, some of you definitely need a better car. Can you get some deals on a GTR? Or so is there like a lease program or something? No. Okay. Even the Leaf, for crying out loud, you need more than that. You know, that thing's pretty zippy. All right. So if you push your foot on the accelerator pedal, right, you go back. And now when you brake, you go forward. Great. When you're turning, you go to the... We're only going to make left turns here because I grew up in North Carolina, and that's kind of all we do on the racetrack. So we're going to make some left turns. So we're going to go here into turn 11 at Laguna Seca. So you're driving on the straight. You're driving on the straight into this corner. What should you be doing? Not yet. We haven't approached the corner. We're on the straight, but we're not yet at the corner, so we should be accelerating. Everybody accelerate. Now we see the corner, and so what do you want to do? Brake hard as you can. All right, now you go into the corner. So you want to ease off of the brakes as you start to corner. Now you want to, like, ease off of the steering as you accelerate. Okay, now as we go to the next turn, we're on the long straight, so we accelerate for a long time. Accelerate. Next corner comes up, we brake down into the corner. Then you ease off of the brakes as you go into the corner. Ease off of the steering as you accelerate, brake. Okay, now do that, like, several hundred more times, and you've got a sense of what's going on. This is what's going out on the track. The combination of the path that you want to take and this idea of always maximizing where you are on the friction circle. Now, your engine limits will actually generally dictate how much you can accelerate, but all cars should be capable of locking up the brakes, so you can really brake at the maximum of the friction circle. Okay, thanks for participating. You may have a seat now. So the thing is, do we see this from real race car drivers? Well, luckily, we have a program. Greg, you're the man. Thank you. Luckily, we have a program with a sponsor who owns a fine collection of vintage race cars, Mr. Miles Collier. So this is his 1960 Porsche Abarth Carrera, serial number 1001. And he actually liked our stuff enough to let us mount GPS antennas and various sensors all over the cars. We had to get kind of creative because he didn't let us drill things the way our colleagues at Audi and VW do. But we actually instrumented a variety of cars. I'll show you some data from various cars and some fantastic drivers. This is John Morton, who is a former IMSA racer, a class champion at Le Mans. Fantastic race car driver. As those of you who work with this stuff know, it doesn't always work. This is the first celebration when we actually got data, which wasn't necessarily the first time the car went out on the track. But we've gotten pretty good at getting data from vintage race cars. And so as we compared this, we found some interesting things. This is turn two at Laguna Seca, known as the Andretti hairpin. And what you'll see here in blue is a line driven by Bruce Canepa. Bruce is the president of the track. He grew up with dirt track racing, quarter midgets and things, and actually set a record driving up Pikes Peak in a semi for the hill climb. So Bruce is that kind of guy. John Morton, a little bit more conventional in his racing style than Bruce. He learned to drive very gently because he said he came up without any funding and he couldn't break the car because he didn't have money to repair it. So he learned to do shifting and everything very smoothly. Now these guys have a very different approach to this corner. What Bruce does is what's known as a double apex. So you see he comes in and he'll steer in to hit this point of the turn, go a little bit wide, steer in and hit this other point of the turn, and go out. John does what's known as a late apex. So he drives out, and he goes a little bit wide, and then hits it in the apex of the turn right on exit, and does this very cleanly. Now, these are lines that are both recorded in a 1963 Corvette Grand Sport that we tested just this past August. And I want to show you what that looks like inside. So first we're going to watch Bruce, and you're going to watch the steering wheel, and you'll see when he actually literally goes towards the apex twice. Okay, so what you'll look for is Bruce is going and doing two deliberate steer-ins. John will tend to go around the corner and steer in here. All right, so here's Bruce. He goes in. Boom, you see the steering as he finds that apex. Now he swings a little wide, hits it again, and out he goes on to the straight. Okay, here's John. He goes in, you see a little bit deeper into the turn, see him away from the center. He hits it right there on the apex and then straightens out onto the track on his way out. Well, we thought, well, this is great because, you know, we've got two incredibly good drivers here. We can actually compare their lap times and sort of see who's got the better strategy around the track. So we compared their lap times here. This is both from their very best laps. They had no cars in front or behind them, so these were pretty clean laps. And when we broke it down, the two lap times were within 0.04 of a second of each other. Now, stop and think about that for a moment. How many of you have actually programmed a simulation, a mathematical model, anything that you did mathematically that you tried to represent the real world? Everybody do that? Yeah, okay. How many of you got within 0.04% of the correct answer? Not a lot of hands. I mean, you know, when we do sorts of things, yeah, well, let's make small angle approximations. Let's do these sorts of things. Yeah, usually we're thinking 10%. These guys are within 0.4% of each other. Now you can say, well, Bruce clearly wins, but John drove the car the second week and we had set it up better. Or excuse me, John drove it the first week, Bruce drove it the second weekend and we had set it up better. So you can say, well, maybe he's got a slight advantage there. But the fact of the matter is, these guys, driving around the track in wildly different ways, with their own style, managed to get out to a very consistent lap time. Their best lap times are close to other laps that they've run, but also extremely close to each other. This is a kind of interesting thing. So let's look at a different comparison. What we're going to do is we're going to look at Bruce. This is, again, his best lap in blue, and red was when he was going for the lead race. So he's got another car here that he's going to be overtaking, which is over to the right. So you'll see that he's moving inside, and he's going to brake heavily and go around here and pass this car. So there you see the Shelby out there. Bruce is going to brake, outbrakes him into the corner, still does the double apex, and blows him away. Basically, regardless of whether he's, you know, racing a vintage car or something like that, you know, Bruce is not going to be denied on his track if he has, you know, equivalent equipment. So let's take a look at that. How did those segment times compare? Well, in his best lap, he got through this segment at 12.26 seconds. On his passing lap, he was faster. Okay, now wait a minute. That's a little bit mind-blowing because clearly we know you need to swing to the outside of the track in order to be fast, but he found another line that goes on the inside. Now, if you look at it, you can say, you can sort of break this down and say, well, there's a couple of things that were going on. First of all, he pushed it much harder around the corner here. So if he had been in a long race, he would have worn the tires out more. But second of all, he was a little bit slower coming out of this corner. And this is where it becomes really difficult to look at individual corners, because it turns out that there's very different initial and final conditions. And so we find that race car drivers may exceed something in one corner, and then the other car falls behind, but they make it up in the next corner, because they set up with better initial conditions. So the corners are very tightly linked, and so sacrificing speed in one corner to gain in the next makes sense. But as we set up the optimizer, there was something that really kind of fell out of this, that in general you have a trade-off between how you go around the corner. I can go to a larger radius, which lets me go faster, or I can actually take a shorter path, more slowly. But if you think about it, sort of starts to offset. And so it turns out that you can find a lot of good ways around a racetrack. Now, that's not to say that any arbitrary path is going to be fast, quite the opposite. But there's more than one way to be fast around the path. So our question really became not how do we find the best, but can we find one of these? And the man who helped us out on this is Piero Taruffi. Piero Taruffi is my new hero. Piero Taruffi had a doctorate in engineering from the University of Rome, and was a winning Grand Prix driver. He won the Mille Miglia in Italy, and was just all around a cool guy who I wish was here to join our meetup, because I'm sure he would. He might even have come to your parties in high school, Greg. I don't know. Seemed like he was a party kind of guy. Liked all sorts of sports, like motor racing. He wrote this great book in 1959, where he broke down all these corners, and said the racing line is smooth, so we can think about it really in these simple segments, curves, arcs, and these transition segments, which we interpreted to mean clothoids, things that change linearly with curvature, because they're basically the simplest possible curve. And so we took Piero Taruffi's ideas and said, well, can we match this to what race car drivers are doing? So we went up north of here a little bit to Thunder Hill Raceway Park, which has some fantastically interesting curves, including Turn 5, which is over a hill, and this chicane here, 11, 12, and 13. We had the president of the track take our Audi around, and this is a comparison of his line. I get you hitting me again there, Greg. Thanks. His line and the line taken by the Audi, by our fitting algorithm with clothoids. Turns out that you can go around the entire track, and with no more than about 20 centimeters of error, you can reduce the sort of 54,000 points, in other words, 27,000 XY data locations, to about 112 straights, clothoids, or arcs. We can take the path that the race car driver is doing, break it down into these very, very simple curve shapes, and it represents the track extremely well. So we thought, well, this is good. If it's not really about finding a single best line, then making this family of curves is likely to give us a reasonably fast line. So we thought from this, all right, if the racing lines are smooth paths, we can capture this with fairly simple curve shapes, at least within the range of driver variability and other things. If there's many racing lines that seem equivalently fast based upon what we've seen from skilled race car drivers and what our optimization tells us, then we should be able to find fast lines using the straights, arcs, and clothoids. So normally this is where I go into the math of this, but it seems like there's probably more interesting things to discuss tonight. I can bring up the math later, but for now I'm just going to say not only should we be able to find racing lines mathematically, but we so what does it look like at the end of the day? I'm going to show you a comparison between a line around Thunder Hill Raceway Park, driven by the president of the track, and one that we calculated based on these algorithms. Now, basically what we're going to find is that the human drives a very good line. The human race car driver is able to find one of these paths around the track that is extremely, extremely good. But the human is going to make very different choices between minimum distance and maximum radius than our algorithm does. And so you'll see as this goes around the track, I've got the time separation down in the corner. And you're going to see that our car wins around one corner and loses it around the next. That the two lines trade off against each other by making these different decisions. Now, we win, according according to our simulation model that we used to develop this. But basically, it's 0.3 seconds on a lap time of around 2 minutes and 17 seconds. So, you know, am I willing to assert that my model is that good? No, I'm not. So it turns out that as we do all of this optimization, we come up with a racing line that seems to be slightly better, but is to some extent within the noise of what we record from an excellent human driver. So as you watch here, here's a comparison. Around certain turns, you see we calculate exactly the same solution. Now here's a big constant radius. I really apologize. I do not have this sort of problem before. Here's a big constant radius turn, and you see that we've got a very different trade-off between shortest distance and maximum radius. And yet, trading off back and forth, we're still about a tenth of a second apart. Now going up to the top of the hill, we calculate almost exactly the same line. Coming off of it again, one of these different trade-offs between distance and radius. As we get out to the edge of the track, you see that it starts to look very, very similar in terms of the desired shape. The lines are almost overlapping each other. But then we get to this point where we're, in fact, able to calculate the shortest distance, whereas the human driver has to go off of visual elements, and so we actually run ahead. Rather similar through this chicane and out onto the final turns. Here you see we make a mistake because we actually stay within the lines, whereas the human driver says, ah, I can drive off a little bit, and gets a little bit of that margin back. All right, so as we pull towards the finish line, our time difference is about 0.31 seconds. So with all of this optimization, all of this math that we throw at the problem, and we come up with something that is within the noise of the president of the track in a car that he's barely driven before. Pretty extraordinary. And I know this is a meetup about autonomous vehicles, but I never cease to be impressed by the bring up the issue that, you know, yes, there's a lot of times when I would love my car to drive itself. But on the other hand, when I look at what the best humans do in a car, I'm pretty inspired to try for that as well. Yes? Yes? Yes. Absolutely. Yeah, yes. So we turn all the systems off, both for David Biden and when we do the stuff in the Audi. We turn off all those systems and do it ourselves. I think the point I'd like to kind of take from that comment and throw it out there is that these systems are designed to help the average driver handle certain driving situations. A combination of systems designed to help the average driver does not produce the performance of the best drivers. And I think that's important as we think about these things going. The lap time with the Audi TT is and the tires that we used is about 2 minutes and 17 seconds. These aren't race tires. These are street tires with a certain amount of wear on that. So if you're thinking, well, it's Thunder Hill, it should be, you know, 2 minutes and 6 seconds if I'm talking about a spec Miata, we're not dealing with that quality of race tire, and that makes a huge difference. So how well can we actually drive this? Can we do the same thing? If we know the desired path and the acceleration profile, can we drive it as well as a human? So this is Shelley, our Audi TTS, where we have seized control of the electronic throttle, steering, and braking. These are pretty near-stock systems. We've added GPS, which we're primarily using for localization on the track. We've added some front LiDAR, which we're using for obstacle avoidance things right now. And we decided to take it out to the track and see if we could track this. Now, there's sort of another talk in terms of how we develop the algorithms for that, but I'll just point out a couple of things that are necessary. We can get a good understanding of what the throttle, brake, and steering commands should be, but we also need feedback. Because when you're driving right up to the limits of the tires, you need to be able to correct when you exceed them. And the two basic corrections that we do are, first of all, we have a lane-keeping-based system where we look at the projected error out in front of the vehicle. And so we can move it back onto the path if we swing wide, but we can also correct if our heading error is wrong. And our heading error may be very wrong in an oversteer situation as the car starts to spin, as you'll see in a moment. Then we actually look at the tires and what the slip characteristics are on the tires. So if we understand that there's a certain amount of force or slip that the tires can handle in the longitudinal and lateral directions, much as you all pantomime for the overall car, we can monitor what's happening at each tire. And if we see one of these things beginning to lock up, or beginning to slide out,
we can take some corrective action as well.
So you put this together and you get the following. Here's Shelly out on the track. With the differential GPS, you see we can steer in and do a really good job of just bringing it right up to the apex and out to the edge of the track as well, depending upon how daring the grad students are feeling. Now you see we come down to the apex again, and if you look inside the car,
that looks pretty chill.
Right, going along pretty happily, steering as it needs to. Now we come up to the hill here, and you see the car is capable of doing a lot of really excellent work to do a combination of braking and steering. So you see the car now has to brake heavily as it goes into the turn, again going right up close to the apex, accelerating down, and from the inside we've got a minor steering twitch to correct, and we're back tracking the path once again. We can get up to some pretty decent speeds on the track. This is zooming ahead a little bit as we go up the hill on the far side of the track. Again, trying to use as much space as possible, which is really important if you want a fast lap time. We get some serious speed, have to brake heavily, turn left out to the apex, turn right over a blind hill, and then if you watch, the car can find a straight path here, even as the road is wandering. So it actually, this is where it makes up some of its time on the track from finding that. Just to show you, it's not always that easy. Here's a day when it was, that's actually a good pause. I can give a little bit more setup here. Here's a day where it was very hot and the brakes faded. And so as we went into the corner in turn one, it turns out we didn't have quite as much friction as we thought. So you can see what that looks like here. Again, we go out to the edge to get into turn one. Come down and whoa, it gets a little bit sideways. To look at it from the inside, you can see what's happening with the steering wheel. Those of you shopping for a new laptop, I'm not really going to recommend this. All right, no, actually, it's a Lenovo Yoga. And so if you watch the steering wheel there, you see we have some pretty dramatic recovery needed, but the car gets right back on track and begins to attack the next corner, so it's just as crazy as the average race car driver. Oh, yeah. Yes. Yes, quite honestly, you know, we are really pushing it right up to the edge of the limits of what it can do. And so there have been times, particularly, you know, in times when it's been raining up there, where you're testing something and it just goes a little bit too far. One of the situations that I thought was most interesting with that was a time that I actually decided to take control of the car just as it was going to begin its braking up the top of the hill. Now, I've been monitoring. I've spent a lot of time, many hours in this car with one hand on the hovering above the steering wheel and the other hand over the big red button. And I took control of that car, and I immediately got on the brakes, but immediately wasn't fast enough. And so the car ended up jumping off of the track far worse than it would have if I had just let it steer around. So there's kind of some interesting lessons here when we think about takeover scenarios. Yes. So yes and yes. Yes, we need to do that, and I'm going to talk about that in two slides. Sort of my finishing thought. No, that wasn't in what you saw right now. So this was simply just steering back with a simple feedback log. Yes, we have Grade and Bank that vary along as well. I will say that there is probably some significant room for improvement in how we're handling that, but the car does know over the course of the racing line an approximation of the grade and bank of the track. This becomes obviously extremely important when you have these large hills and you have these downhill situations. Yeah, we do. We try to be as physically driven as possible. So we don't don't like to go out too many different canes. We like to try to do everything as much as possible with physical parameters. But the thing is, any of you who've ever done racing know your tire property is going to change tremendously as your tires wear and as the temperature of the track changes. You know, those of you who've been at Thunder Hill know that you can have a nice, pleasant, like 75 degrees in the morning, and you're dealing with 110 in the afternoon. That's a little bit different in terms of the tire parameters. So one of the things that we will do is to generally do a ramp steer test to get some basic characterization of the tires that we use as a baseline, but then the car can vary that as it goes. So we do calibration on that. Yeah. Yes and no. Depending upon what we're doing, we do have the capability of estimating it, and I'm going to motivate that in a moment. In the particular video that you saw with the recovery, we were not doing online estimation of that. So if you look at it, this is the friction circle that you all drove so well standing up. And as you see, our car does a really nice job going from accelerating to braking and along the edges of this. This is really the engine limit, which varies according to speed. It's essentially a power limit. But you see, we do a great job of doing that. We do a great job of controlling tire slip, and yet we're still not as fast as the president of the track. We're getting there, but we're still a few seconds behind him. Well, it turns out that if you look at these are representing the slip circles or the capabilities of the tires. We do a really nice job of staying in there, except when we're braking and have to do sort of the ABS functionality and it dips out for a moment. We do a pretty nice job, except on a couple of those spins, of staying within the slip circle on the rear tire. And you see that, oops, oh, we're going to go online with this. That'll make it even more exciting. I think if you just go down to the, yeah, perfect. Thanks, Craig. So we do a nice job of respecting the limits of the tires, and the human driver doesn't. The human driver is actually content to go way out here in the front, saturate the tire tremendously to make sure that they're never below the limits. So not only is the human driver able to get a racing line about as good as we can calculate from optimization, they don't obey the slip circle limits. They don't stay within the lines. Our great controller getting 80-90% of the slip circle is not fast. It's slow because we're leaving that little bit on the table. So it turns out it's not that simple as just to say, well, all right, let's let us saturate the front tires, because then you're plowing. You're plowing through the turn. It turns out we don't know exactly what the friction limit is, and many of your questions have brought this up. How do you know what U really is? It changes with tire temperature and track pressure, and drivers are amazing at sensing this. I talked with Gilles DeFerrin, who won the Indy 500, and he's done a lot of tire testing. And I asked him, I said, well, how many laps does it take you when you put on a brand new set of tires that you've never driven before? It's a new formulation. How many laps does it take you to get up to the absolute limits of the car? And he looked at me and he goes, laps? Chris, I wouldn't have a job in laps. Two turns that you're up. He's like, you've got to have a local understanding of how everything changes with the tire. So you get two turns and you're off and running at the limits of the car. So it turns out that a little uncertainty of friction can cause big problems. And this is the picture I like best to illustrate this. This is coming into a turn at about, this is meters per second, so coming in at about 52 meters per second into the turn here. I've got a 3% error in friction. All right, so this would be about what's happening as I'm coming into some of my faster turns at Thunder Hill. If I've got a 3% error in friction, if I think friction is greater than it is, then you see as I come into the turn, I'm braking, but I'm not slowing down quite as much as I think I should be. So as I come around here on the friction circle, now I'm going a little bit too fast. So I actually need a little bit more of that friction to stay in the turn than I thought, which means there's a little bit less available for braking, which means I'm going slightly too fast, which means I need a little bit more for lateral acceleration. And so I can't possibly get to my desired speed profile. I end up coming here not at 35 meters per second, but at 36 and a half meters per second. And you say, hey, Chris, what's a meter and a half per second among friends here, right? Well, if you translate that into radius, that's 12 meters, okay? That's a big difference. If I have misestimated friction, if I'm trying to drive up to the limits, and I've misestimated this by 3%, which is awesome if I can get it within 3%, I'm off the track. I'm not only missing the apex, I'm missing the pavement on this. So it turns out that this whole entry problem, this idea of braking before I get into a turn, is a very stiff mathematical problem. And so we've got basically two options to this. One is to go in conservatively, which is where we thought we could do. That's not going to make us fast. The other is to change our path based on conditions. But if we do that, our controller really is no longer hierarchical. And so many people who look at autonomous vehicles say, well, we do path planning, and then we go and we do things with a low-level control. Well, if you try to do this in that fashion, good luck. Because the path planner says, do this, and the low-level controller goes, no friction. You can't do that. So several things that we've learned from this that really I think are very interesting to developing autonomous vehicles. Much of the path planning for autonomous vehicles comes out of the computer science field, where you'll generally think of the world as a grid and say, let's connect the dots and then smooth it. It turns out that if you start with this sort of connect the dots and smooth it, you rarely end up with one of these smooth paths that the race car drivers generate. There are many fast ways around a racetrack, but this is not the way to find one. So the whole approach of thinking about working around the limits, thinking about getting up to the limits of the car, you want to be smooth and then fit that smooth path around the obstacles, as opposed to thinking about something that fits around the obstacles and then smoothing it. So clearly there's a need to sense friction. We've got several approaches to doing this. And then to adapt the path according to new information so that the controller can really pay attention, go into a maneuver, realize it doesn't have as much friction as it thought, and very quickly replan the maneuver. It turns out that driving the path is the challenge. Finding the path, finding a path around a racetrack was not the problem that we thought it was. So how do we use all of this? Well, I want to take this from just a pure racing setting and leave you with how this relates to day-to-day life. So I want to look at a lane change maneuver. So we're going to look at an emergency lane change where we're coming in at highway speeds and we suddenly need to change lanes to get around the car. So we want to basically brake and corner to get around this and then accelerate again so we're up to the speed of the traffic in the other lane. Well, it turns out we can do the same thing with the straights, clothoids, and other things we did on the racetrack. We can use exactly the same algorithms to be able to drive this. And so if we do that, it looks like this, which I'm going to have to do manually because that was the one change which I didn't save earlier right here. This is from the roof of the car. What you're going to see is we're going to go to the start-finish line. When we go to the start-finish line, the car senses that there's a blocked lane in front of it and executes an emergency maneuver. So it goes one, two, there's a start-finish line, wham. It's able to do the emergency maneuver. This is what it looks like from the in-car view. The human heads here are kind of your G-meter. They move to the side and move back. And finally, this is what it looks like if you are the obstacle. Recorded that the first time, and we put it on the center of the obstacle, which made a lot of sense for perspective. And then we're like, no, no, we need to put it on the edge of the obstacle. Looks much. Okay, so my goal here has been to hopefully convince you that by looking at the world's best drivers, we can learn a lot that helps us with autonomous vehicles. So first of all, I think a measure of respect is in order. Humans can be amazing drivers. They are truly extraordinary how they can get to the limits of the car's capability. So we really want to take lessons from them. More than one good trajectory exists. We don't necessarily have to get hung up on the optimal trajectory so long as we have an awesome trajectory. Right? So long as it's sufficiently awesome, we should be fine. And there's a number of trajectories that satisfy that. Now, it turns out that the race car analogy of either I go on a tight radius slowly or a large radius fast goes to this lane change problem as well. I either brake early so I can steer sharply later, or I steer more gradually at the beginning to give myself a wider margin. And depending upon how close you are to the obstacle, there's a good choice within that range of trajectories. So the things I want you to think about is that, you know, going forward, you really do need these inherently smooth paths. That's what we learned from race car drivers. But the uncertainty and friction is really our limiting factor. And this is the one thing that we haven't been able to easily reproduce from the human. Their ability to, within two turns, really pay the changing conditions of the car. Now, we haven't given up on that, so we figured let's just wire up their brains and figure out what's going on in there. So we're literally looking at some of the brainwave patterns of drivers. We're talking with them, working very hard to kind of take that next step to get this characteristic of human response into the vehicle. And I think this is where, you know, as the question came up earlier about stability control or traction control that you want to turn off, we're really seeing that the recovery processes that expert drivers use really beat the heck out of these systems, which is the reason why most race car drivers want them turned off. So for autonomous vehicles in the future, can we really learn these recovery, these stabilization techniques from the world's best drivers and program them in there? So hopefully we're on our way eventually to drive as well as the very best humans in the world and to at least put one piece of this puzzle together into autonomous vehicles where we can literally make these cars as safe as they can possibly be. So thank you very much for your participation and attention. I'd love to answer some questions and, you know, I'm happy just to stick around after the formal session and chat for as long as you want. Actually, let's go. Ed had his hand up first, and then we'll go. It's a really good question. I don't have the, you know, I don't have the data, and we're starting to work more with a range of driving skills right now to be able to handle that sort of question. And the question is, yeah, do you need to be at the 99th percentile or the? I mean, these guys are way beyond the 99th percentile of performance. How far out on the tail do you have to go? I think that's a really good question about what people will ultimately accept. As a researcher, we want to pin our sights on being as good as possible. And I think if we can solve these problems and, you know, we can implement this with production hardware and actuators we have on the TTS, then the question is why not be as good as we can be. In terms of where we are right now, we beat anybody on the team in terms of lap time. We're not beating the president of the track, but we're within a few seconds, and we've actually found some things. So we're hoping by the end of the year we'll be pretty competitive. He's made us agree to back once we beat him. So I suspect our rabbit may find a few tenths to make it more of a challenge. I think that let me kind of, you know, commingle your questions a little bit, because I think it answers the case. I think right now there's a bit of a question of what is an autonomous vehicle. And, you know, many manufacturers, not to single anybody out, have talked about having autonomous vehicles on the road in 2020. And my understanding is that the autonomous vehicles definition that will be on the road in 2020 is whatever people have on the road in 2020. So there hasn't necessarily been a strong definition of exactly what this will take, but everybody kind of agrees that's the date. I think there's a big separation between, if you're familiar with the NHTSA levels of automation that have been proposed, a level 2 system, which would be a combination of adaptive cruise control and lane keeping that still requires the driver to monitor, and a system where we literally say, the car is in control, go ahead and test. And in my mind, this is a bigger barrier than is, I think, acknowledged at the moment. Because as soon as you let the car be in control, the car is making every decision. The car is actually deciding what kind of accident you will have. And if you think about it, maybe the car is doing everything perfectly, but somebody else swerves into the lane. Now you need to think, what should the car do? Does the car have a responsibility to protect me because I'm the owner of the car? Does the car have a responsibility or a sense of justice in that the person who started the accident should pay for the results of that accident and should be a maximum collision there? Does the car take the risk of going into the other lane, which might avoid this accident, but now raises a potential of an accident with an uninvolved third party for which the car may now be responsible? This raises a lot of legal questions and also ethical questions. And so I feel like the sense that once we make this step and we say the car is truly responsible, the driver does not have to monitor it, even for a short period of time, that car is taking actions that will have many legal and ethical interpretations. And the question really will be, when is society comfortable with that? When will the potential advantage of this in terms of lives saved, in terms of time saved, balance out this idea? And when, when will this be something where, you can imagine the media stories of the first autonomous car involved in an accident, or how these sorts of decisions will be dissected. So the answer is that we I think we need to have a discussion. This is one of the reasons why I love coming out and giving talks like this to people who are really interested about this, in the idea that if we start a dialogue, if we can get people to understand that these cars may be really good, but they're not going to be perfect, how do we deal with that? How do we accept that? If we can start that conversation, then I think we can move that answer away from never to sometime. Absolutely. But I think the thing is that people don't think about cars and airplanes in the same way. I agree that these are good analogies from a scientific standpoint, but the fact of the matter is an airplane is this uncomfortable seat that I go into, and I'm aware that there's a human being up there. But as an average consumer of airline travel, I'm not sure that people have it in the same sense of thinking about it as something that they interact with on a daily basis. So that's one of the things. If you can move to full automation, or the dedicated lanes of the automated highway ideas in the 90s, then it becomes much easier, because the real issues are that the car is now calculating things that obviously the car can have many better outcomes from these calculations, but it will be imperfect. That's a good question. People don't necessarily buy cars like that today. You can make a similar argument that even in the hands of a skilled human driver, more predictable handling could be much safer. It clearly will be the case if you have cars that can drive themselves up to the limits in an emergency situation. Cars with better limits are going to be safer cars. That's exactly right. I think if you look at production automotive systems, the ratio is something about 10 to 20% of the code is for the functions, and then 80 to 90% are really for diagnostics and safety. That number may actually, that percentage of actual code to diagnostics and safety, may actually increase further, or you may have even more diagnostics and systems like this. But it becomes very important. Throttle control systems really have two redundant circuits. The systems that we use on the Audi TTS, we have redundant computers to check each other. And so I think this becomes really, really important, and maybe one of the barriers, particularly if you start deploying multiple sensors, and your camera tells you you see something, but your radar doesn't. Is your radar failing, or is that a trash bag, or you don't get a reflection off of, or how do you interpret that? These sorts of sensor fusion and diagnostic questions, I think, really are key to a lot of so from a legal standpoint, there's interesting issues because it's not only your choice, right? You're now on a highway with people who didn't necessarily expressly consent to drive on a highway with this, to use some of the terms that my legal friends, Brian Walker Smith, uses. So there are questions. I think this will be, ultimately decided in the near term by what manufacturers are willing to put out, what insurance companies. That's going to lead any government regulation, in my mind, is really going to be what people are willing to put in the marketplace. I think we're horrible at evaluating risk, and we're horrible at evaluating randomness. One of my colleagues I'm working on a project with, Hermann Vinner at Darmstadt, really has a nice way of phrasing this. He says, as soon as we start moving, we assume some risk. There is a certain amount of risk that you assume in return for the ability to drive at 65 miles an hour and to locomote at that speed. That's not the same risk that you take by staying at home and remaining stationary. Now, I didn't weigh that risk when I thought about should I drive over here for the meetup or when I accepted the invitation, because I accept that. It's a level of risk that is low enough, but it's not zero. And the thing is that we really do have some issues with wiring in our brains where we want this sort of perfection or clarity of things. We want to know that this is not going to fail. What do you mean the system can fail? When I got involved with the Toyota unintended acceleration issues and talked to a lot of reporters, they were like, well, are you saying that there is no problem with Toyotas? I'm like, I'm not saying that. Okay. No engineer should say, there is no possibility. We don't deal with percentages of zero. If somebody asked me, it's like, does Bigfoot exist? I'd be like, I haven't seen any evidence. I don't know. Am I going to tell you no? No, that would be irresponsible. You can't prove a negative. So then the media immediately turns it around and goes, aha, so you're saying that there is a chance of an error. It's like, so then you say that, and then on the news, you're like, we just interviewed Professor Chris Gerdes at the Center for Automotive Research at Stanford, and he says there is a chance that there is a problem with these vehicles. And it's just like, people, really, how do we have this conversation? How do we have this conversation about low but acceptable risks when there's sort of this black and white framing of everything? So I think you're absolutely right. The question is ultimately what risk is going to be accepted? Who's going to be the one to take that risk originally? Is it going to be one of the OEMs? Is it going to be a software manufacturer without prior vehicle experience? I don't mean that in a facetious way. I just mean there's very different approaches. You say, well, of course this is going to go from the automotive. They've got the experience. But there's some interesting surveys that people have done where many people would trust an autonomous vehicle by Google or Apple above that from an OEM. Survey that I heard, and you think you're like, what is Apple done? I love my iPhone, everything they do, but I'm not aware they've done anything with autonomous driving. Google has cars. Yeah, that's it. Oh, they may not be made of plastic though. Hey, Quinn. So, one of the things, kind of a fun story I'll share is that one of our original test vehicles was built with Nissan to do diagnostics and safety on steer-by-wire. And the project that we were working on, our colleagues at Nissan then took that and turned it into the direct adaptive steering system for steer-by-wire system that Nissan has. So I've often said that we look at issues that are 10 years out, but now I've been doing this for 15 years, so people can call you on that. So it's nice to see that some of the things that we worked on are now actually getting into products. I think some of the things that we've done with friction estimation, some of the emergency maneuvering things, those have a lot of application prior to full autonomy. I know a lot of European manufacturers, motivated by the insurance industry, interestingly enough, are looking at pedestrian avoidance systems and things that could actually swerve out of the way or brake or do things to avoid pedestrians. And so some of the very simple ways that we have of generating simple paths quickly and being able to drive them up to limits could be a possible spin-off there in the near term. Well, you know, I don't know that they do that. Although I think there are some cultural differences in displaying this. Because I was just at a conference in Japan, and there was this research group that was showing, you know, what would happen if you didn't avoid this collision. And they had this photorealistic animation of this kid running across the street, and the car just running. And we were like, oh no, you didn't do that. And they had it like on this loop up on it, and so you had this horrendous scene playing out right after it. So. Oh yeah, but you know, I've got two boys at home. I go to conferences to get away from that. So I think, you know, these are some things in the spin-offs of the research. I think, you know, I'll give a plug. I've got some of my colleagues in the audience tonight from Peloton Technology, and this is a startup company that I'm consulting with to help get started looking at platooning heavy trucks. Now this is actually going back to my Berkeley days, but the fuel savings you can get and safety improvements you can get by using forward-looking radar and cameras on heavy trucks, bringing them to closer spacing distances is really pretty extraordinary. You can eliminate certain types of accidents that are very common in heavy trucks, and you can get, you know, fuel savings on the order of 10, 11, 12%. So I think that's a near-term thing, which I'm not doing in a university lab because I think it is a production system. Well, let me introduce you to some of the Peloton folks. We'll see. Maybe we can get some cross linkage going on. That's what these meetups are supposed to do, right? Okay, and then I'm willing to stick around if people are interested. So long as they don't kick us out of the building, and so we'll find a bar. Yeah.
Yeah. Well,
So when you say sophisticated algorithms, actually our algorithms run on a computer which I suspect has less computing capability than your laptop and maybe than your phone. So actually it doesn't require that much to run this. It takes, you know, PhD students cranking through to come up with the solutions, but the algorithms are actually pretty slim. We've actually been pretty sensor agnostic. The reason we've been using GPS is that it kind of tells us where we are, and we're able to go out and look at the algorithms and study the comparison with the humans. So it really allows us to get right into the research that we think is most meaningful. This is obviously a big problem, and we're a small lab. You know, I've got four graduate students, sometimes five, working on this project part-time while they take classes and things like that. So we're not going to solve the whole problem of autonomous driving, and so we've tried to scope what we think we're really good at. So the GPS was a way of getting there. The LiDAR is a way of saying, okay, now that's really not enough, clearly, we know that. So how do we start to blend that in? How do we start to deal with the uncertainty in decision-making and everything? So we started with something that made our lives easy, and we're walking our way out from that. Cool.
Okay, round of applause.